America, observers are fond of saying, is the only country based upon an idea. That idea, that all men and women are created equal and have inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, is directly informed by the Enlightenment, the philosophical and scientific movement that dominated politics, culture, and ideas in the 18th century. But are we still an Enlightenment nation? The Enlightenment principle that we can apply reason and sympathy to enhance human flourishing may seem obvious, writes Steven Pinker in his new book, Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. He continues, I wrote this book because I've come to realize that it is not obvious. Pinker is a linguist who teaches at Harvard and is the author of, among other titles, The Better Angels of Our Nature, The Blank Slate, and How the Mind Works. He's been named among the top 100 most influential public intellectuals by Time and Foreign Policy, and he's been highly critical both of conservatives who deny evolution and progressives who say there are no meaningful biological differences between men and women. Not surprisingly, Enlightenment Now has been attacked by right-wingers who find it insufficiently respectful of tradition and left-wingers who say it's an apology for capitalism. Reason spoke with Pinker about the need to document not just material but moral progress over the past several centuries, the ongoing need to defend free speech and open inquiry, and whether he's optimistic that our future will be better than our current day. Let's start by defining the Enlightenment. What are its basic pillars, and what are some of its impacts on the world? And I guess those are two very large questions.
Yes.
So what comprises the Enlightenment?
My potted view of the Enlightenment identifies four themes: reason, science, humanism, and progress. Reason being the ideal that we analyze our predicament using reason as opposed to dogma, authority, charisma, intuition, mysticism. Science being the ideal that we seek to understand the world by formulating hypotheses and testing them against reality. Humanism, that we hold out the well-being of men, women, and children and other sentient creatures as the highest good, as opposed to the glory of the tribe or the race or the nation, as opposed to religious doctrine. And progress, that if we apply sympathy and reason to making people better off, we can gradually succeed.
Why did the Enlightenment happen when it did? And obviously, you know, it's not as cut and dried as saying, when Kant wrote this, begins the Enlightenment, and then when, you know, Thomas Carlyle said something, that's the end of it. But you know, why did it happen when it happened?
Because it only happened once. We don't really know, and we can't test hypotheses. But some plausible explanations are that it grew out of the scientific revolution of, say, the 17th century, which showed that our intuitions and traditional view of reality could be profoundly mistaken, and that by applying reason, we can overturn our understanding of the world. By the age of exploration, the fact that there were entire continents that previously were unknown and that required rethinking an entire worldview. Maybe more approximate technological kickstarter was the growth of printing technology. Printing technology was the only technology that showed a huge increase in productivity prior to the Industrial Revolution. Everything else had to wait for the 19th century.
Yeah, and you talk about how, I mean, basically between the year 1000 and about 1800, in many places, people had very little increase, if any, in material well-being.
Yeah, economic growth was sporadic at best. And most technologies showed very little increases in efficiency. But printing technology did take off in the 18th century. And pamphlets were cheap and available, and broadsheets and books, and they got translated. They circulated across all of the European countries as well as the colonies. So the exchange of ideas was lubricated by that technological advance. And another possible contributor was a historic memory of the wars of religion. And that showed that dogmas about faith and scripture and interpretation and messiahs and so on could lead to tremendous carnage. And they thought, well, let's not do that again. So these are all the ingredients.
Yep.
Which one was causal, we don't know.
A large section of the book is kind of documenting the incredible progress that we've made. By any, I think even the most anti-progress person would have to say, okay, well, yeah, people are living longer. People, you know, fewer women are dying in childbirth. Fewer kids are dying in the first 5 years of their life. What are, for you, are some of the key markers that show the impact of enlightenment principles or enlightenment thinking to our world?
Certainly the conquest of hunger, the fact that now we've got this problem called obesity, the obesity epidemic. As historically, as problems go, that's a pretty good one to have compared to the alternative of mass starvation.
And you mentioned in the book, if I'm not misremembering, in some of the poorest parts of the world now, people are getting something like 2,400 calories a day, which in the U.S., that's 400 calories above what the USDA recommends that a middle-aged man eats on a daily basis.
Right, yes.
So that's a good thing.
Yeah, there still is hunger. There are famines in war-torn remote regions, but by and large, the famine as one of the horsemen of the apocalypse has been tamed. Just sheer longevity, the fact that in the world as a whole, life expectancy now is 71. For most of human history, it was 30. Literacy, the fact that 90% of people under the age of 25 can read or write. In Europe, a couple of hundred years ago, it was 15%. And less obviously, war has been in decline over the past 70 years or so. The chance of getting killed in war has plummeted. Crime has declined, even in a pretty crime-prone country like the United States.
Well, it's worth looking at the long scale, right? Because it's crime actually started, kind of violent crime on a day-to-day basis started declining in the late Middle Ages, right?
Yeah, so that we can't credit the Enlightenment for that because
right.
It was kind of the transition to modernity.
Right.
But it was,
but
it got
kept
another
going
boost.
Down.
Yeah, it kept coming down. And it got another boost in the 19th century with the formation of professional police forces and with a more systematic application of criminal justice. And then in the 1990s and the 21st century with data-driven policing, like the New York's CompStat program, which put the police where the crime was starting to grow before it could explode in blood feuds and cycles
and
of vendetta.
The whole idea of having a prison sentence or a sanction against a criminal fit the crime. What was going on there, and how was that different than what had come before?
Well, prior to the Enlightenment, there were gruesome criminal punishments for what we consider rather trivial misdemeanors, like drawing and quartering, cutting a person open, ripping out his entrails while he was still alive and conscious.
I'm sure he was guilty of something, right?
Right. Poaching, criticizing the royal garden. Then in the 18th century, largely through the arguments of Cesare Beccaria, who coined the term the greatest good for the greatest number, later picked up by Jeremy Bentham as the motto for utilitarianism. He argued for proportionality, not so much to satisfy some cosmic scale of justice, that the punishment must fit the crime just because that's how justice is inscribed in the heavens, but just to set up the right incentive structure. Because he pointed out, if you're going to apply the severest penalty to rather minor crimes, then criminals could just say, well, why stop at that? If I'm going to take a chance, I may as well go all the way, kill the witnesses, families, if I'm going to get the same punishment as just burglarizing their house in the first place. So it was a real rational incentive-based argument for what seemed like a kind of cosmic principle that the punishment should fit the crime. And it was an example of just the rational analysis of societal institutions that went beyond gut feelings of appropriateness, went beyond just sheer cultural inertia, and said, well, what is the rationale? Why do we, why should we punish more severe crimes more severely?
I'm quoting you here. You say, the world has made spectacular progress in every single measure of human well-being. Here is a second shocker. Almost no one knows about it. Why don't we acknowledge it more?
Some of it is that we have no exposure to it. That if our view of the world comes from journalism, since journalism is oriented to discrete events, things that happen, not things that don't happen, there are, as long as rates of violence and hunger and disease don't go to zero, there'll always be enough incidents to fill the news. Since our intuitions about risk and probability are driven by examples, the availability heuristic, then we can get a sense of how dangerous the world is that's driven by whatever events occur, and we're never exposed to the hundreds of thousands or millions of locales where nothing bad happens. That you can assess with data because it goes into the denominator. You count the number of, say, violent acts as a proportion of the number of opportunities. When you see the data, you realize, my God, our risk really has gone down. But if you're just being exposed to particular criminal acts, it could seem the same as ever. I think there's also a moralistic bias at work that pessimists are considered morally serious and optimists are considered kind of frivolous. As Morgan Housel put it, pessimists sound like they're trying to help you. Optimists sound like they're trying to sell you something. And we attach gravitas to the doomsayer.
You start the book by invoking Donald Trump's inaugural address, and you know where he talked about American carnage. I mean, actually using those words, and it was one of those moments where it's like, you know, I think a lot of people, even some supporters of him, were kind of like, what world? Like, he seemed to be describing New York City circa 1975, as opposed to the United States in 2016. Is there a point where having more sources of information available actually will kind of countermand the negativism of the news?
Depends on what the information is and how it's presented. Certainly, if we had more attention to data on trends as opposed to discrete events. That is, if a news story on a terrorist attack or a school shooting or a drug overdose said, oh, and by the way, this has been the trend for the last 40 years or even the last 20 years, and if the op-ed columnist did not interpret yesterday's news as itself a trend, if we remembered that, by definition, one data point is not a trend, we'd be better off. Also, a little bit of history, not going back centuries, but even going back, say, to the 1970s.
Well, that's what I don't understand, is that people who, you know, lived in the 1970s should be calling bullshit on that kind of stuff. But
you think.
Does your memory change as you age?
There is some of that, that especially the negative coloring of events in the past tends to fade. So you remember everything that's bad about what's happening now. Some of the awful things in the past, they lose their negative connotations.
How do you prevent yourself from becoming Panglossian? Yeah. And just saying, because there's no question, compared to certainly 500 years ago, we're much better off. So, you know, stop complaining and, you know.
Of course, Pangloss, as Matt Ridley points out, was a pessimist.
Yes.
An optimist thinks that we can, the world could be much better than what it is today.
And of course, he does have syphilis. So it's like, you know, his world could be a lot better than this.
And Voltaire was really satirizing Leibniz's argument for theodicy, namely God had no choice but to allow earthquakes and tsunamis and plagues because a better world was just ontologically impossible, and that's what Voltaire was satirizing. Well, just to really to stick with the data and to note that some things really do get worse. Right now, for example, the opioid epidemic is clearly an example of something getting worse. And there have been, it is certainly not the case that progress has been monotonic. There have been fantastic setbacks. The Spanish flu epidemic in 1918-1919, World War II, the 1960s crime boom, AIDS in Africa, lowered life expectancy. So you've got to be aware of cases where not only progress has gone backwards, and that could happen again, but also of low probability but high impact events, such as nuclear war, such as the possibility of catastrophic climate change.
Let's look at some of the groups that are anti-Enlightenment in your argument. And the first one I want to talk about is the Romantic Green Movement. What do you mean by that phrase, and who are these people?
Yes. Well, my particular foil for that would be Pope Francis. And I know that arguing with a man who's infallible, this must be the ultimate exercise in futility.
But it also, you know, that's why you have tenure, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this is the idea that humanity made a terrible mistake when it began the Industrial Revolution. that we've been raping and despoiling the environment, which has been getting steadily worse and worse and worse, and we will pay the price in a dreadful day of reckoning. We'll be poisoned by our pollutants. There'll be epidemics of cancer. There'll be collapse.
And so even if we did have 200 years of progress from 1800 on, you know, where the clock is about, the alarm is about to go off and everything's going to turn bad.
That's right. Yeah. Or in fact, that the progress that we've experienced so far is illusory, since we're breathing in carcinogens as we speak, and since species are dropping like flies, and so actually our situation is getting worse and worse and worse. This movement tends to be opposed to the technology-driven increase in living standards over the last couple of hundred years. Tends to see humanity as a kind of scourge on the planet. And I, in the book, I acknowledge that concern with the environment certainly is a good thing, and we have the Green Movement to thank for reminding us that there can be harms to pollution and. However, there is an alternative approach to protecting the environment, sometimes called eco-modernism or eco-pragmatism, that first of all acknowledges that that pollution has been a price that we have paid so far for enormous benefits to humanity, more than doubling lifespans, emancipating slaves, emancipating women from domestic drudgery, emancipating children from farm labor and getting them into schools. That some degree of pollution is worth paying, just as some amount of dirt in your house is worth it, because the effort to keep it perfectly clean would mean sacrificing everything else good in life.
Yeah, and this is part of the humanism, right? The idea that, I mean, humans can, it's not that the world exists merely for us to, you know, blow it up if we want to, but rather that, you know, a lot of green romantics don't seem to put any value on human flourishing.
Such as, for example, an example would be the implacable opposition to genetically modified organisms, which promise increased nutrition. In fact, promise enormous environmental benefits, namely crops that need fewer pesticides, fewer fertilizers, less acreage.
Less water. Less resources.
Yeah. So paradoxically, that would be a perfect case in which adherence to a romantic ideology that what is natural is good, what is human-made is bad, actually can harm the environment. Another aspect of eco-modernism is the recognition that affluence in general is good for the environment, that when people are so poor that electricity itself offers a big leap in their living standards, they'll live with an awful lot of pollution in return for electric current coming out of the wall. Once you get a little bit richer, then, and you're starting to choke on smog and you can't see the horizon, you're living in purple haze, then when you get a little bit richer, you're willing to pay for the pollution control devices that give you the electricity without all the pollution.
This seems to be part of what's happening in China, where 50 years ago, they were worried more about, you know, after Mao's Great Leap and the Cultural Revolution, you know, they just want enough to eat and they're willing to industrialize without thinking about air pollution, say. And now you're starting to see within China more, as they get richer, as Chinese people get richer, they want cleaner air.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a perfect example of that. And the fact that the world's most polluted areas are poor countries. Poverty is the greatest polluter.
Although this is where I think kind of neo-Marxists would say, well, that's because we're, you know, the rich part of the world, or the North, or whatever you want to call it, the OECD countries, are pushing, they're immiserating, we're exporting our pollution to
yes.
poor countries.
I mean, that's not literally true, in that most of our pollution can't be exported because it's involved in generation of power and home heating and so on. Also, the fact that a lot of the pollution in the developing world comes from burning wood, especially indoors, or burning wood or dung, and from contaminated drinking water.
You write, the enlightened response to climate change is to figure out how to get the most energy with the least emission of greenhouse gases. And let's talk a bit about climate change. And first and foremost, you know, you believe that climate change is happening and that it's, you know, that human activity adds to it, right? I mean, I think,
yeah.
How did you come to appreciate nuclear energy, and how has that been, how have people responded to that?
I came to appreciate, well, partly from thinking it through, that that we really do need scalable, abundant affordable energy, particularly in the developing world, where there's a moral imperative to allow India and China and Africa to enjoy the benefits that we've enjoyed from abundant energy. And the fact that a lot of our dread of nuclear energy comes because nuclear energy hits all of our cognitive buttons for our fear response. It's novel. We can imagine a catastrophe. It's man-made as opposed to natural. There are a few salient events that lodge in our cultural memory, namely Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and now Fukushima, despite the fact that the human damage in each case was trivial compared to what we tolerate day in, day out from burning coal.
Yeah, could you focus on that a little bit?
Yeah.
Because I mean, I hadn't thought about it in these terms, but you mentioned about 60 or 100 people died directly in Chernobyl.
Yeah, and then there probably was a slightly elevated cancer rate,
right.
Barely detectable
right.
among the
children and whatnot. Later, I know the UN did a follow-up study, and it turned out that children were fine who were exposed, but there was definitely a higher cancer rate.
A little bit, maybe just barely above the noise.
But in Fukushima, which is most recent, but Three Mile Island, and this is something that kind of haunted my childhood
sure.
because of the China syndrome.
Yes.
Really, so we're actually looking at a relatively minor event
yeah.
at a nuclear power plant, but then a movie that had been out for a couple of weeks and then became a huge thing.
And by sheer coincidence had the line, it could contaminate an area the size of Pennsylvania.
Right, yeah.
And then there was the No Nukes concert with the Doobie Brothers and Bonnie Raitt.
I think that irradiated the Doobie Brothers more than the world. But I think so. But is this a case where that, we can imagine the disaster, like the disastrous outcome, and that overwhelms any kind of cognitive
yeah.
ability to be, to talk about this stuff more rationally?
That's right, because the far greater number of deaths that come from fossil fuels, from mining, from transporting, from the pollution, particularly the particulate matter, it just never happens all at once in a photogenic event that makes the news. But coal probably kills, according to one estimate, about 1 million people a year from pulmonary disease and coal mining and transport. But that doesn't make the headlines. So the combination of just that background with the fact that some of the world's leading climate scientists, like my MIT colleague Kerry Emanuel, James Hansen, themselves embrace nuclear power because it simultaneously promises a reduction in carbon emissions, but with provision of abundant energy that we need and that the developing world needs even more.
And you talk about how this is another thing we're kind of stuck in the past, because basically Three Mile Island and then certainly later Chernobyl put the ice on any American nuclear power plants. It's extremely difficult to get licenses, et cetera. But there's been a lot of progress in coming up with different models and smaller power plants, right?
Well, there is the promise of fourth-generation nuclear technology. That's not the same as fusion. But in small modular reactors that can be cranked out in shipyards and anchored offshore and moved out of the way of storms and tsunamis and so on, traveling wave reactors, thorium reactors, liquid salt reactors, a number of technologies that are kind of in the pipeline, probably won't come online for another decade or more. And within the pro-nuclear environmental movement, there's a bit of a debate over whether we should just go with tried and true second-generation designs, where it's climbed the engineering learning curve and we know what can go wrong and how to prevent it, versus putting the bet on technologies of the future.
You also note that France and Germany, for example, which are countries, and France in particular, which gets a lot of electricity generation out of nuclear power, they're moving in the direction of getting rid of it, right?
And their carbon emissions go up. And that's what happened in Germany, because when nuclear power plants are taken offline, they're replaced by fossil fuels.
Part of the green romantic movement in general, or romantic green movement, is this idea that you can get something for nothing, because you talk about if you wanted to use wind energy or solar panels, there's a vast amount of area that would need to be covered with these things in order to generate the demand for the type of energy we have.
Well, and also the wind is sometimes becalmed and the sun doesn't shine at night and clouds come and block the sun.
The sun doesn't shine most nights, right?
Most nights, yes. It's a statistically significant generalization. And so even with the enormous penetration of photovoltaics, which is clearly a good thing. There's a limit as to how much of the energy demand it can assume, since a modern economy also has to provide energy at night, and there are long periods of time in which there's pretty thick cloud cover. And if we just need a fossil fuel backup for solar, then it doesn't really help with reducing carbon emissions, because we still have to have those gas or coal plants.
In your reading of the data, what are the odds that the worst case scenario or a bad scenario is going to happen? And then what's your favorite solution?
Yeah, I couldn't assign a number to it. It strikes me as high enough that we should rationally prevent it from happening. We should reduce the tail risk. Whether there would be a kind of soft landing of the so-called lukewarmer position that acknowledges human-made climate change but says, well, it may not be so bad after all.
Or that we can build our way out of it kind of by being more resilient.
By adaptation.
Holland has done a good job of
that. We're going to have to do that no matter what,
right?
Because some degree of sea level rise is baked in. So that's going to happen no matter what. And so obviously we shouldn't impoverish society so we can't afford to do that. But there's a range of pretty gruesome scenarios as to how high sea levels could rise, of possible flips like the Gulf Stream being diverted that would turn Europe into Siberia. Not definitely going to happen. High enough of a probability that seems to me we should worry.
And then
about
your preferred fix to this is a carbon tax. How would that work, and what is its function?
The idea would be to internalize the externality of emitting carbon that could result in climate change that harms everyone, but without the command and control mechanism where someone decides what source of energy we should use, what conservation methods we should adopt. The advantage of carbon pricing is that the decisions are distributed across hundreds of millions, literally billions of agents who can weigh off the various trade-offs of the benefit that you get from fossil fuels as opposed to the cost that the carbon tax would impose.
And in some plans, it ramps up over time, so there's an adjustment period and all of that.
Exactly. So that, in fact, that it can be, that also incentivizes the development of lower zero carbon energy sources, where if you know that you're going to be paying for a lot for carbon 10 years down the line, then you'll invest in technologies now that would maybe allow you to avoid the carbon tax altogether. And then people could make trade-offs for themselves as to whether they want to eat less meat or drive less, depending on their own priorities. And it could be revenue neutral, depending on how it's implemented. It could, as Al Gore, who I don't quote all that often, but said, tax what you burn, not what you earn,
right,
in arguing for a trade-off. And there are different ways of implementing it.
Right. I know people in the libertarian movement are worried about a carbon tax because it can become a brave new source of revenue for governments to do for whatever they want and things like that. And
if that itself is the concern, then it could be offset by tax reductions elsewhere.
Right. Yeah. And well, that's where pricing it so that you don't create a weird market or a false market that causes misinvestment or malinvestment.
Right. And that risk can never be zero because
right.
No one's omniscient.
Yeah.
So, but I think having one is better than not having one.
What about anti-science or anti-enlightenment people on the right? Because there are some people on the right who hate modernity because of environmental concerns, but it seems that the anti-enlightenment attitudes on the right come from different sources. Who are the major players there, and what's motivating them in your sense?
Some of them are religious, that we can't play God by extending human lifespans, or conversely, that we don't even have to worry about climate change because God wouldn't let any bad thing happen.
Or it's part of his plan.
Fourth part.
Yeah, that's a pretty safe position, right?
Yeah, I mean that's what happened with Noah, I
right.
guess.
Right. Yeah.
Part of it comes from something that's called theoconservatism, the idea that the Enlightenment roots of the American social order were kind of a big mistake. that it just has led to relativism and to homosexuality and pornography.
Women
and
drug wearing
use.
Pants.
and worse, yes. Just decadence and degeneration. And that, because the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness is just too tepid for a morally robust society. So we need something, some sort of rock-solid principles, which conveniently are provided by religion, particularly Catholicism, because Protestantism itself has become too liberal, according to this mindset. And this was a movement that distrusts science for the Promethean usurping of power from the gods, especially when it merges with classical liberalism and other Enlightenment values.
Well, it seems to me that in a way, there are two major legacies of the Enlightenment. One is scientific progress, so the idea that we can and should investigate all aspects of the natural world and of the social world and get to understand that better, and that. That, in a weird way, leads to things like Darwinism, where or other forms of scientific determinism, where we know why things happen and they're going to happen in pretty predictable ways that limit our autonomy and individual a sense of individualism. On the other hand, there is the political legacy of the Enlightenment, which is the idea that each of us should be able to run our lives more than we might have in the past, because we're all rational agents. And thinking agents, and should be given that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And is there a tension between those two legacies? Because in order to, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness means we have an open society, and open society means we sometimes come across scientific discoveries that tell us, well, we're not that special, or, you're never going to be a baseball player.
Yeah.
I'm never going to be a Harvard professor. And that seems, how do we maintain equality in the political sphere while everything in our knowledge starts to tell us we're more and more unequal?
We have to embrace the ideal of political equality and equality of opportunity and equality of treatment under the law, as opposed to equality of outcome. So that's just an inescapable consequence of the fact that we're not clones. We're genetically different. Men and women aren't indistinguishable. Not all individuals within each sex are indistinguishable. But it really has nothing to do with equal treatment before the law if you adopt a principle that we're not going to prejudge an individual by the characteristics of his or her group. And I mean, that's a moral, political decision. I think it's justifiable, and it's one that we can stick to.
Do you worry at all, though, that when people start talking about intelligence, even, and it doesn't even have to go to kind of racial or ethnic group disparities among averages and groups, which may or may not exist, or exist, it may not mean as much as people want, but among individuals, if we start to find out more and more of like. Well, this person really isn't capable of doing this level of thought work. How do we maintain a commitment to political equality?
I don't think there's any tension between that and political equality. Give that person a chance. Try to maximize what he or she can accomplish within the envelope of possibilities made available by nature. We know that there's considerable scope for human improvement, just because education matters and institutions that result in economic growth have worked. Democracy has increased, violence has decreased. So when you put together billions of people, particularly since we are, even though we're products of evolution, one of the things evolution gave us is this brain that is massively complex, not completely predictable. There's a lot of randomness that goes on in both the formation of the brain and its day-to-day operation. The brain processes information, and information can be exchanged without loss. If I teach you something, it's not that it's subtracted from my store of knowledge, but it can therefore proliferate and multiply. It can accumulate. And the fact that we're cognitive creatures that live by ideas that we can share, we can innovate, that accumulate, means there's huge scope for social progress, even though we're fitted with probably the same brain as our ancestors thousands of years ago.
So we're still waiting for that firmware update.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like an Apple iPhone. It's always coming out next
right.
year, right? Let's talk about the postmodern critique of, or post-structural postmodern critique of Enlightenment. And you talk about people like Nietzsche, Foucault, Michel Foucault, Jean-Paul Sartre, Max Horkheimer, and Theodore Adorno. What was the nature of their critique, and is it substantially different from some of the things that we've already talked about?
It didn't take long after the Enlightenment for there to be a counter-Enlightenment movement. The 19th century Romantics, the cultural pessimists like Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, which led to the Frankfurt School of Horkheimer and Adorno, and to existentialists, and then to the postmodernists, which rejected pretty much every one of the Enlightenment ideals. Reason was just a pretext to exert power. The individual was a myth that the individuals are just embedded in a culture, and it's the culture that's real. One strain of that led to blood and soil nationalism, that what really exists is the culture, and we're just sort of cells of a superorganism. There's no such thing as objective truth, but just competing narratives. And far from there being progress, there has been deterioration, and any moment now the entire society will collapse.
Did you go through an existentialist phase at any point, or a romantic phase?
You know, I really didn't. For one thing, the prose was so impenetrable that I just didn't enjoy reading it.
And, you know, Camus and Sartre are pretty good
Sartre,
writers.
Being in nothingness was a tough
read. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. And Heidegger is the worst of the bunch, really.
And, you know, Camus was a fine novelist, but I actually hated the Stranger.
Yeah.
I thought it was psychopathic, but anyway.
Yeah, I think that's the point, but I don't pretend to understand it. Heidegger, in many ways, I guess, is the ultimate of this anti-Enlightenment sensibility.
And Nietzsche.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, because Heidegger was an actual Nazi, so, which was a very romantic counter-Enlightenment movement. And he, at one point, I know even Herbert Marcuse disowned him after World War II. He wrote an essay where he compared concentration camps to kind of factory farming.
Put them,
you know, and it was kind of like even Marcuse was like, yeah, that's a little bit much. You know, there's something wrong with your brain pattern. But are there critiques then of Enlightenment that you find convincing? Because you kind of push away all of the negative things. So say something like Nazism, in a way, is a kind of perverted understanding of, or totalitarianism in general is often considered, and this, I guess, is Adorno and Horkheimer saying, well, you know, Enlightenment is totalitarian because it's going to fill every aspect of human being, and that we see this in Nazism or in Stalinism or in Maoism, where, and, you know, you say, well, no, they weren't. These are perversions of Enlightenment. But
no, Nazism was not an Enlightenment movement. It was
right.
I don't think you can trace it back to Adam Smith and David Hume and Spinoza and James Madison. I mean, it really was counter-Enlightenment in valorizing the tribe over the individual. In its iconography, kind of venerated pagan origins and rootedness in nature and tribal symbolism. It was opposed to liberal movements of the 19th century that tried to generate wealth, reduce injustices, maximize flourishing of as many people as possible. These were all anathema to the
And I
the
might add, the Catholic Church in the 19th century, I mean, the First Vatican Council was explicitly aimed against democracy or representative government and capitalism or laissez-faire because it...
Precisely, yes.
As Enlightenment, outcomes of the Enlightenment. But here's a quote from Marquis de Condorcet's Perfectibility of Man, which I first encountered in Hayek's book, The Counter-Revolution of Science, subtitled Studies on the Abuses of Reason. And this is from the Marquis, who was very much a man of the Enlightenment and who died in the French Revolution. The sole foundation for belief in the natural sciences is this idea that the general laws directing the phenomena of the universe, known or unknown, are necessary and constant. Why should this principle be any less true for the development of the intellectual and moral faculties of man than for other operations of nature? Our hopes for the future condition of the human race can be subsumed under three important heads: the abolition of inequality between nations, the progress of equality within each nation, and the true perfection of mankind. And, I mean, the Marquis de Condorcet is a paradigmatic
You can't explain him away as not the Enlightenment.
I mean,
that's true. Yeah.
And it seems like this kind of hubris, really, of the idea of moving from natural phenomenon to human phenomenon.
Yeah.
It makes total sense, and it's a leap. And You know, isn't that part of the Enlightenment legacy that we always need to be kind of working against?
Yeah, and the Enlightenment itself had many contradictory strains, and they argued against each other. So it's in the very nature of the Enlightenment that it wasn't a doctrine or a catechism of beliefs. And so so it would be impossible to say everything about the Enlightenment is worthy because they disagreed with each other. And there also was an critique of the Enlightenment from Edmund Burke that we're just not smart enough to design a society from rational principles, that we should respect tradition and social structures, even if we can't explain their rationale, because they keep us from teetering over the brink.
Right, and obviously his great example of that was the French Revolution, which restarted the calendar and everything and leveled all sorts of past institutions.
So here's the way I would put it, though. So the Enlightenment as a party, as a doctrine, as a movement, obviously is filled with flaws, just because these were, they were just guys. They couldn't have gotten everything right on the first try. They disagreed with each other. There's a lot of stuff they didn't know. They didn't know evolution. They didn't know thermodynamics. So it's really the ideals that I associate with the Enlightenment, namely reason, science, and humanism, that we ought to venerate. And the thing about reason is it can always step back and take into account flaws in reason as it's been practiced up to that point. In fact, that's the only way that we could, in theory, uncover problems with the way people reason, is we're using reason as the benchmark against which we say that people have fallen short, and it can give us the next steps to making us all the more rational. I mean, there's just no way out of reason if you're talking in the first place.
You talk in the book about how politics makes us dumb, and you talk about this both in terms of politicization makes us dumb, both in politics, but then also in academia. Let's talk about those. First off, what's the general argument that politicization of things makes us dumb? What's going on there?
People identify with really what you might call tribes, and leftism and rightism have become tribes, and will evaluate any idea, empirical or policy proposal, in terms of how well it conforms with a particular set of ideas that happen to be associated with that tribe, will resist evidence to the contrary, will demonize those they disagree with. And there are, in fact, studies that show that people, even evaluating data from a hypothetical experiment, if it's politically neutral, like the efficacy of a skin cream, they'll do a decent job at interpreting the numbers. But as soon as it's a political hot button, like concealed weapon laws, then they'll systematically misread the data in the direction that favors the position associated with their coalition.
Right.
Daniel Kahan deserves credit.
Yeah, there's a cottage industry of where you go out with a bunch of Trump positions and read them to liberals, and they'll say like, oh, I think that's a pretty good idea, until they hear it's from Trump, or vice versa. Right. Trump's people will hate them, but it's like, this is your guy.
Precisely.
Well, what are the ways around that?
Ideally, it would be reminding people that that this phenomenon exists, that political tribalism makes them make math errors, that it is a human failing, that we should evaluate policies based in terms of evidence as to what their effects are and how well they conform with what we want.
When you take like the argument from authority away or tradition, it's like,
you feel so at sea.
That really hurts if you agree with it, right?
That is the idealization. But of course, if we were rational enough to accept that, we probably wouldn't have fallen into the tribalism in the first place.
Well,
perhaps with a more of an appeal to our emotional selves would be to find spokespeople who are branded with the opposite coalition to speak in favor of a particular position. In the case of climate change, it'd be far more effective if there were people on the libertarian right who were chosen as spokesmen, as opposed to, say, Al Gore, who was the Democratic candidate for president and vice president, and to frame issues in a way that doesn't immediately trigger your tribal affiliations. And we do know that issues can flip. An example that I mentioned is that environmentalism used to be thought of as a right-wing position, because these were gentlemen in their country estates who valued the view, and duck hunters who wanted the habitat preserved for their ducks, whereas serious progressives cared about real issues.
Yeah,
like,
no, they want to put a dam everywhere so that they could provide energy for hillbillies and stuff, right? Yeah, and poor people. So
exactly.
Well,
yeah.
You in the book, and I took this seriously. You chastised the libertarian right for embracing a rigid dogma over serious introspection on things, and you talk about how kind of like a worry about too much regulation immediately becomes it's not even a slippery slope. Libertarians will go from okay, this regulation gets introduced, and then we're at the final terminus of the road to serfdom.
Next thing you know, we're Venezuela.
Yeah. And so what are ways, and one example that you use, or one illustration, is the idea of a few years ago raising the top marginal tax rate, and I guess this was under Clinton, from 36% to 39.6%, which was widely seen on the free market right, certainly, as like, okay, this is going to kill the economy.
Yeah, or it's the first step for jackbooted stormtroopers taking away our liberty, right?
Is the slippery slope argument, is that something that came into practice in the Enlightenment? I'm wondering. I don't remember a lot of slopes in the Bible.
But it's right. Like,
so, but then in terms of academia and the way politicization or politics makes people dumb in academia, you quote at one point John Maynard Keynes's phrase that all madmen in authority are usually in the grip of the ideas of some dead economist or political philosopher. How does this politicization affect, you know, particularly you? I mean, you're an academic, you're an intellectual in the academy. What are the worst elements or outgrowths of this kind of politicization as it affects you on a daily basis?
Well, there's some hypotheses that are hard to advance without being branded as a thisist or a thatist. Mm-hmm. The fact that men and women aren't indistinguishable, the fact that intelligence is in good part heritable, the fact that parenting doesn't have a lasting effect on the personalities of children, the fact that rates of crime differ across ethnic groups, the fact that policing has a large effect on the crime rate and incarceration as well. I could go on. We just mentioned, the fact that free market economies are both lead to greater prosperity and greater peace.
Is one of the biggest problems that because of the politics of these situations, you're not even supposed to discuss them or investigate them or kind of walk around them like they're a car on a used car lot and kick the tires and everything.
Yeah.
Is that the real problem with the current academic
environment? Well, I think there are two problems. One of them is simply that we can't converge on the most likely hypothesis if there's some hypotheses that are just undiscussable. As John Stuart Mill said, he who knows only his own case knows little of that. And so it's only in the crucible of ideas and debate that you can converge on the truth or the most likely hypothesis. The other is that by making certain hypotheses undiscussable, you open a niche for people who stumble across them outside of the sandbox of academia. And they will not have an opportunity to debate them either, and they can often attach themselves to the most extreme versions since they don't get any pushback and in fact can feel empowered that they've discovered a truth that's undiscussable in academia, all the more reason to think that they have the truth. And so you get communities in the alt-right that often embrace quite liberal extreme views because they feel so exhilarated that they've come across them, and then they don't get any pushback. I mean, a silly example would be Milo Yiannopoulos saying that because women place a greater emphasis on family versus career in their lifestyle trade-offs, we should keep women out of medical school because they're just going to drop out and have babies. So that's the kind of extreme alternative to the dogma that men and women are indistinguishable. I mean, it is actually a fact that there is a difference in the distribution of life priorities between men and women. Of course, it doesn't mean that all men place 100% of weight on their career and 0% on family, nor vice versa for women. There's enormous overlap. And of course, there are moral and political arguments why, even if it were the case that more women drop out, we would not want to keep them out of medical school. But that debate doesn't even take place if you can't even acknowledge the fact that men and women have different distributions.
And it's in the university, it's not the Milo Yiannopouloses of the world that are keeping that conversation from happening.
That's right, yes. But these views can kind of fester
right.
in these alternative online communities. Likewise, another example that I've given is that you can't really understand crime in this country without noting that there are pretty severe differences in rate of incidence across different ethnic groups and races. So that's almost undiscussable, even though you just go to the FBI website and look at homicide statistics for African Americans and European Americans, and they're pretty different. But if that's undiscussable, then you stumble across it, because you go to FBI.gov, then you might think, oh, well, it just shows that African Americans are inherently more violent, which, of course, is nonsense, because rates of crime across ethnic groups are never identical. And at other points in American history, it was the Irish Americans who had the high rates of violent crime.
We were number one for a while.
You could actually, by suppressing a basic statistical fact, it can actually encourage racism
right.
in these alternative communities, because they never get pushed back in an arena in which all hypotheses are out there and their limitations can be rationally discussed.
What happened? Because, I mean, you've been haunting universities for, you know, the better part of 40 years, right, as a student and as a professor. I can remember in grad school in the late 80s and early 90s, I had a lot of professors who had gone to Berkeley in the 60s, and their whole ideal, I mean, I was libertarian back then, and they didn't particularly agree with me about a lot of things, but they were interested in discussing and arguing them. That seems to have faded from the university. What has gone into that, where the university is no longer the place where you argue all ideas, you know, and get rid of the ones that really can't, you know, go more than a few rounds without being revealed as, you know, lightweight?
Yeah, so I don't know the exact history. And there was a fair amount of intolerance in the 70s.
Sure.
It was not exactly a golden age for speech. A lot of speakers were, as we now say, deplatformed. E.O. Wilson, when he published Sociobiology,
was getting water poured over the head. That was like when that was a good day for him.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, they're chanting mobs and so on. It does seem to have gotten worse in the last 5 to 10 years, and I don't know if it's that the baby boom generation that itself had some intolerance toward non-leftist views then became the establishment, and so they established norms that then the millennial generation internalized. There is the theory that because millennials have been so overparented, they're, you know, they're snowflakes, they can't stand, you know, hurtful ideas, meaning ones that they have never heard before. That's one theory. I'm a little skeptical of that theory.
Is it coming more from the faculty or people on campus, you know, adults on campus, or the students?
I think a lot of it actually comes from neither. It comes from the student life bureaucracy. The various, you know, deans and associate deans and Title IX administrators and affirmative action administrators that have formed this new guild that operates out of the control of the ordinary university chain of command, with a president and a provost who rose from the faculty and presumably have some commitment to intellectual values. But this is an autonomous culture that moves laterally from university to university. They have their own norms. And the control of a lot of student life has kind of been outsourced to this bureaucracy. It's absolutely burgeoned. And so I think, I'm guessing that some of the phenomenon is that they've been, the intolerant students have been abetted by the face of the university that they deal with most directly.
One of the great values of the book to me was you discussed C.P. Snow's early 60s Two Cultures essay, where he talked about scientific culture and a more kind of humanities-based culture, and what he saw then as a terrible gulf that was growing up between those. And you argue, and I think pretty persuasively, that gulf has not been shrunk at all. It's, if anything, it's bigger. How does that play into this? I mean, is there Are the humanities, which everywhere seem in retreat in university in terms of majors, in terms of funding, in terms of kind of prestige, are they part of the problem here in dismissing kind of Enlightenment values in academia?
Yeah, I think so. Not so much the humanities in the sense of every scholar who looks at works of art and texts and histories of history of ideas, but there is a kind of culture in the ethnographer sense in large parts of academia and cultural criticism that replicates this gulf that Snow documented in the early 60s. And Snow was viciously attacked by a literary critic named F.R. Leavis. And it's quite remarkable to see a similar debate playing out today. A hostility in this culture to science being part of the of human accomplishment as opposed to just giving us some useful gadgets. Even a hostility to what I consider the Enlightenment value of enhancing human flourishing everywhere. Leavis attacked Snow, who I think quite presciently said that science is not just intellectually beautiful in explaining how the cosmos works in deep and elegant theories, but it has an enormous moral promise in alleviating early death and malnutrition and disease in the developing world, kind of anticipating the whole UN Sustainable Development Goals and Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the fantastic progress that was made long after Snow died. And Leavis said, well, who cares about babies in the third world? What really matters in life is appreciation of excellent literature. That's what we should live for. And this is a weird dichotomy. But I still see it now, and it shed light on a mindset that otherwise I could not understand. But I've seen three or four proponents of the humanities saying that what really matters is consuming elite art. That's the highest moral value, and it's somehow vulgar to worry about calories in the developing world. I mean, who cares about that? That's boring.
You make a case for the humanities. What is that briefly? And is that a way of kind of, at least finding people in the humanities that are interested in having a dialogue rather than kind of just excoriating?
Yeah, and a lot of people in humanities are. Well, if the humanities are defined as what the study of, say, products of the human mind, of this symbolic creations of including art, ideas, political philosophies, and so on, then that, of course, is there shouldn't be a debate between the science and humanities. We've obviously got to nurture scholarship of artists and writers and thinkers, past and present, and that has to be reinterpreted every generation with new understanding, both of sources and of the greater intellectual context. But it's just this particular set of assumptions that happens to have taken over big sectors of the humanities that I think is a source of the problem, including obscurantism in expression, the fact that by far the most turgid, jargon-ridden prose comes out of postmodernist humanities, the deep cultural pessimism and hatred of the institutions of modernity, the equation of liberal democracy with fascism, the feeling that society is in ever worsening spiral of decline, and the lack of appreciation, I think, of the institutions of liberal democracy that have made the humanities possible, made them flourish. So that cluster of ideas, which is not the same as the humanities, but just happens to have descended over large sectors of the academic humanities.
You're making a defense of the Enlightenment, which means that you're worried about its saliency and its relevance to contemporary intellectual life and cultural life. Are you optimistic that it will, that your intervention here will help kind of restart a debate or kind of at least delineate the terms better?
The honest answer is I don't know. I think it would be grandiose to say that my book will change the situation. I'm doing what I can. But the optimism that I'm associated with in this book isn't just thinking that everything is bound to get better. It just has to. There's some law of nature that will carry everything ever upward. It's really more an empirical defense of progress. We have made accomplishments. They're precious. We're always in danger of losing them. And what will happen going forward depends very much on the choices that we make now.
We'll leave it there. We've been talking with Steven Pinker. He's the author most recently of Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. Steve, thanks for talking.
Thanks so much, Nick.
For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie.